Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Heather Henderson back at the Sydney Institute. She was last here in 1994, launching a book on the Liberal Party of Australia, but on this occasion, Heather Henderson's here having edited her own book, Letters to My Daughter, Robert Menzies Letters, 1955 to 1975. So we've asked Heather Henderson to come along and talk about the letters that her father wrote to her over a period of 2 decades, and there's great material in this book, but we'll hear all about it. So Heather Henderson will talk to us for a period of time, and then we'll have some questions and discussion and sign some books and whatever else. But as Heather Henderson's getting up, just thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this terrific facility tonight. And Heather Henderson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard. And I'm glad you did. Can you? Probably no loss if they can't. I'm glad he didn't put a time limit on it, because I can remember when my father was well retired and he was interviewed at home, and his nurse was there, and his nurse said to me, "It was the most extraordinary thing. Your father sat there and the members of the press said, well, now we'll have a rehearsal." And he said, "I don't have rehearsals." And he was informed that he must have a rehearsal, because otherwise how do we know how long you're going to speak? You must speak for precisely 1.5 minutes. He said, "Very well." So they said 10, 9, 8, 7 blast off, and he started. He spoke and he stopped precisely at the end of 1.5 minutes. And the boys of the press said, "I have never seen a performance like that in my life." So I tell you that so you know this will be different. What's not entirely different is that I can remember he went on an election tour, well, frequently he went on election tours, and he said, "By the time I'd been round Australia and the last lot was Tasmania, and I stood there and I looked at the audience and it was going up and down in front of my face, and it was sheer technique that kept me going." Well, I can assure you, you are all going up and down in front of me, and I have no technique. But I'm really here to talk about the letters. And I started writing about my parents. And in the course of that, I got out the letters that my father had written to me, and I showed them to Peter. And he looked at them, and he said, "Boy, does it make a good book?" So he was so fired with enthusiasm, he went out and bought a duplicating machine, copying machine, and he copied the whole lot twice, having first put them in proper date order. And we sent them to 2 friends who knew a lot about books. And they both agreed. One of them was had been a publisher, and he knew a lot about books. And he said, "If I was still in the publishing world, this would be a draft contract." So that was very encouraging. What was less encouraging was that we showed it to 2 lots of publishers who said no. The second lot was we were dealing with a friend of one of our daughters, so I knew her. And she said, "I like it." But the sales department said no. And I can't go against what they say. And I said, "Okay, where do we go from here?" And she said, "I think you go to a literary agent and let them do the dirty work." Well, I just hope her sales department lived to regret their decision, because the literary agent found Murdochs who agreed to do it, and now we have what I think is a very good looking book. So hooray for that. Even so, I agonised a lot about whether I should publish the letters or not. There's a lot in them that's not very kind about people. When my father retired, he wrote two books, and he was very careful not to criticise people who would be hurt or families who would be hurt. It was not a book full of recriminations, neither of them were. But many years have passed, and it is now, it's interesting to know what he said about people, but also he didn't criticise them in a particularly vindictive way. He did it in a rather clever and colourful way. The families might not agree, but we have cut out an awful lot of juicy bits, and they're all on the cutting room floor. You might not think so when you read the book, because there's still quite a lot in it. But the letters were in fact written for my eyes and ears. We saw Doug Anthony not long before the book appeared, and we showed him a few bits and said, do you think we can leave this in? For example, about Jack McEwan, etc. And he read it and he said, look, it's history. I think it's history. Just put it all in. It doesn't matter. So I am putting all the blame on Doug Anthony. A lot is revealed about what people thought about him. And he's included letters. He was asked to write an obituary about the Queen Mother by the Times of London, which was pretty flattering. In those days, the Times was a reputable paper. And particularly, I like what Nixon said about him. Nixon said, if I were to rate one post-war leader even above the others, it would not be one of the legendary European or American figures. It would be Robert Menzies of Australia. But also the letters revealed something about himself, quite a lot about himself. When Peter and I lived in the Philippines, I met Mrs. Marcos, and when she heard who my father was, her first words were, oh, that sense of humour. Now, that is something that comes out in this book that I think is worth it for that reason alone. People now don't know what sort of sense of humour he had. They don't know he had one, because we only hear about, you know, the Rip Van Winkle years or something. But we don't hear about his humour. Yes, we've all heard about his meetings where people interjected and he had good, crisp answers. But only the elderly amongst us will remember those things. Except I know there are a few young people around who will remember, because I met a man who said when he was quite a young boy, his father used to take him to my father's meetings. And they would get there at 6:30. The meeting started at 8:00. They'd take their sandwiches and sit in the front row. And he said one night there was a woman yelling out, and she was waving her hands and yelling and yelling and yelling. And Dad said, I can never hear what women say when they yell out like that. So his only defence was to think of something else. And eventually he stopped and said, yes, madam, of course. It's through the door and down the stairs. But with the book, it's been very gratifying. Somebody rang me the other day and said, my husband is sitting at the table laughing because he's enjoying the book so much. and a young woman in the publishing house read the whole book, and she said, "Ah, but he's got such a great sense of humour." So good. That's what I want people to realise. It's important. Another thing he reveals is his great affection and regard for his family. And sure, me, but apart from me, my mother, my brothers, his brothers and sister. His own family was extremely united, and they were great support to each other, and they never wavered. They were always there for him. And I don't think he could have coped without that support. He talks about my mother in one bit. He says, and again, what a gorgeous way of putting it. "I'm back in Canberra from Brisbane, where I went to explain the facts of political life to 800 businessmen at a dinner, and then my reminiscences of legal life to 400 lawyers. Your mother, who is, I regret to say, mentally afflicted, is having a succès-fou, a little French, in Queensland and New South Wales, and will not return until Saturday. 20 speeches in a week. In the result, the Liberal Party gains votes in spite of me, and my own eccentric life continues." And then he worries about my mother doing too much. And after retirement, he wrote, "Your dear mother simply cannot delegate her responsibilities to others and is therefore always on the run." And that made me laugh, because I could just imagine my daughter saying, "You have got some of your mother in you, haven't you?" Because that's me. But not all the family comments are very flattering. He says about his nephew James, "Young James has reached, by careful inattention to his studies, the intermediate class at Trinity, but is not expected to go further academically. This is a pity, because he is a not unattractive lad, and I believe plays the kettle drum with remarkable talent." But I would like to add here that James has forgiven me and bought 5 copies of the book. He took a great interest in his grandchildren. And when our eldest daughter was 5 years old, he wrote, "Edwina's question, 'Was God born?' has filled me with delight. This, in my opinion, is the most profound theological question ever put. It suggests to me that this girl should end up either as the first female president of the Rationalists Association or the first female primate of Australia." And then there was a little bit about the youngest child, because when my parents were in England once and we were posted in London, we went down to Walmer Castle, which was the seat of the Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports, which is what he was. And he had a flat there. And we stayed there for the holidays, school holidays. And we went out on a hovercraft across the Channel to France to have lunch. And there was great discussion about what people were going to have for lunch. What do the French eat? French eat snails, they eat frogs. What are we going to have? I'm going to have frogs. And finally, Sibby, who was then about 4 or 5, piped up and said, "I'm going to have snails' legs." Dad loved that, never forgot it. Great success. Now, another thing that comes out very clearly is the fact that he was not a snob. And again, I'll quote a couple of little bits, because he talked about somebody who was a mutual acquaintance, and he said, "His snobbery is so gratuitous and ill-founded that I'm almost coming to enjoy it." But the best one is a description. When they'd had some people, some friends, Yes, they were friends, staying at the lodge. And he described the two ladies' confrontation like this. "I wish you could have been with us. If I had time, I could write a piece about it, which could rival De Quincey's Murder Considered as a Fine Art." The two ladies sat, devoid of all humour, looking at each other with the fierce eyes of rivalry, dredging up out of their memories all titled people they have ever met, and wherever possible referring to them as Tom or Mary. It was a magnificent encounter. Never a laugh, but never a dull moment. Now, the other thing was, I've lost my place. That's stupid. See, I shouldn't do this. Here's how erudite he was, and how he, his letters, private conversation, making speeches, he always seemed to quote something. He had an amazing capacity for words. And an English journalist who met him and spent some time with him wrote an article. And he said, sorry, "He can season the talk with a ready sprinkling of literary allusion and quotation." So, it's true. And in these letters, we see a lot of examples of it. As our late friend, the author of Proverbs, said, "Better a dinner of herbs with those you love than a stalled ox and hatred therewith." And after a rather curious and uncomfortable gathering, he said old Shakespeare was right, not for the first time, when he said, "Time and the hour runs through the roughest day." And when something had gone wrong in my life, he said, "You must comfort yourself with Browning's famous line, but sudden, the worst turns the best in the end." It seems extraordinary that he apologised for not writing enough. And he wrote to his family, he used to write family letters, and they are in the book as well, to his, mainly to his brothers and sister, but to everybody else in the family, and they were passed round. And in one of those he said, "This will be my last family letter before my return. I seem to have averaged about one a month, which is rather a poor performance. Yet, and Frank can check this one," Frank was the acknowledged biblical expert in the family, "my average may still be better than that of the Apostle Paul, though the quality of the epistles should not be compared." So you wonder where this business of quoting, remembering all these things, came from. Because he always had an apt quotation wherever he was. And it started, I think, with no words at all, when he was in Jeparit at the local state school. The inspector came round, and they were all told to be on the best behaviour. And the end of it, Robert was to speak, stand up and say thank you. So at the end, the headmaster, Mr. Livingston, said, "Well, now Robert will say a few words." So Robert stepped forward, and he looked up at this big man, and he licked his lips, and he wriggled, and he looked down again, and he swallowed, and he looked up, and the teacher said, "Thank you, Robert." So that was the first speech. Not a word. And he went from there to school in Ballarat, where he lived with his Scottish grandmother, who, according to him, or to my aunt, was a mean old woman. But whether she was or not, I know not, but she was very strict, and any misdemeanour was punished by being made to learn a chapter of the Bible or a psalm or something from the Bible. So that's where his knowledge of the Bible came from, because he had to learn when he was a small boy. And he then went from there, he got scholarships, went to schools, and he loved poetry. He wrote poetry, but he had a great feeling for poetry. He wrote to his granddaughter, Dwina. They had a really good correspondence when she was late teens. And he said, when I had a big speech to make, I would begin by making brief notes, merely as a reminder to me as to what my line of argument was to be, and relying upon the moment to produce the words in which I would clothe the ideas. The night before the speech, I read poetry, because great poetry gives one a sense of the weight and quality of words, which perhaps no other reading can do. Well, it worked for him, it wouldn't work for all of us. But there he was. His brain was full of the Bible, poetry, Shakespeare, songs. It had to come out somewhere. And it did. And we all know those now famous words, I did but see her passing by. But when he spoke at the dinner for the Queen, it was perfectly natural for him to quote. My Uncle Frank used to sing at the piano, and one of his songs was, I know a lady sweet and kind, you know, I did but see her passing by, yet I shall love her till I die. So we all knew that song. He knew that song. And at the time, it was quite appropriate. People had been standing, sleeping, all in the streets, waiting to see the Queen. And they did but see her passing by. What the ABC does not tell us is that Mr. Corwell spoke at that same dinner, and this is what he said, Mr. Corwell being the leader of the opposition. Our speeches here are, of course, quite unnecessary to assure Her Majesty of the warmth of that welcome. It will come much more directly, much more eloquently, from the millions of men, women and children who will see and be seen by her in the course of this visit. I think if my father was here today, if he knew what had gone on with the ABC, he would not be surprised, but he would sympathise with Rachmaninoff, because Rachmaninoff composed the Prelude in C-sharp minor, and his friends loved it, and they kept saying, play it again, play it for us, play it for us. And in the end he said, I wish I'd never written it. And I'm sure Dad would feel the same about the words he used. On the other hand, I'm sure you will enjoy a little bit in the book about the ABC and what he thinks of the ABC. Page 160. But he made hundreds of speeches. He went from there on, and to me, one of the best was the speech he made at Churchill's funeral. He was very het up about it. He was worried about it. He wasn't sure if it was good enough. And when it was over, he went back to the hotel, and he knew that a friend of ours was in London, Charles Lloyd-Jones. Many of you will have known Charles, the son of the other Charles Lloyd-Jones. And he said, Charles, I know you will tell me the truth. Was I any good? And Charles said, Sir, I was proud to be Australian. You have never made a better speech. What is so extraordinary that little tongue-tied boy in Japan went through his life and spoke to the world on that occasion? What a transformation. Well, there's a bit of a ramble on, but I think I must go back to the book. So far, I haven't been pilloried for what I've done. I've had nothing but very kind comments about the book. I do believe now that I have done the right thing. I think that readers can see the side of Menzies, the human side of Menzies, which is the whole point of publishing these letters. You can see what sort of person he was. The Canberra Times had a review of the book by Jack Waterford, and he ended up saying, talking about me, "She has done him and us a favour." I like to think he was right. And best of all, my friend from way back when we were both about 5, who knew my father well, of course, she said, "Your father always had a way with words, and it's wonderful to hear him speaking again."
So thanks for that. That was terrific. So we'll have, firstly I should say again thanks to Clayton Lynch for this great facility tonight, and if you, when you're exiting, then you have to exit up on level 15, not on level 14. So let me come to questions and discussion. All of you here know, but there are some people who will be watching on Channel 648 on Austel and Foxtel. So we're talking about Robert Menzies, Prime Minister of Australia from 1939 to 1941, and again from December 1949 to January 1966, and the letters to his daughter Heather Henderson, which were written between the years 1955 and 1975. So I think it's a great book, so well done. So can I ask you about those of us who have written about Robert Menzies ourselves? I wrote an essay in my book, but Ellen Martin wrote a two-volume biography, and Ellen Martin addressed the Sydney Institute on both occasions about Volume 1 and Volume 2, but I don't think Ellen got access to these letters. Why did you not let the letters out a bit earlier? I mean, Ellen Martin was writing in the early 1990s and the late 1990s. I guess he would have liked to have read them too, because they're very informative. So what was the reason, and why did you let them out when you did? I mean, is there a possibility you never would have let them out? So what's behind all this mix?
First question is, yes, Alan Martin did see the letters. But as far as he was concerned, they were private, they were personal. He got a lot of information from them, which he didn't use specifically, but it certainly affected the outcome of some of the things he said in the book. We didn't publish it before because we didn't think of it. I probably would never have thought of it. It was Peter who thought of it. So that's the answer.
So we should say thanks to Peter Henderson.
Yes.
Well done. Of course, many of you know, but for those who may be watching on television, and Peter Henderson was a senior diplomat in the Australian Foreign Affairs Department for many years, which explains why Heather Henderson was overseas so often, which explains why her father wrote to her, because she wasn't sort of living down the road or anything. So that explains all that. So, okay, now we've got a bit of time, and Anne. Speak up a bit. We've got to get caught up.
You made a comment in the book that, in your introductions, that after your father left office and was no longer a player, his letters then were the letters of a watcher. Did you find that some of his letters then revealed more personal comments about people? I mean, how did they change? Did he become less informed or more open?
I suppose, in fact, he was less informed because he wasn't in the centre of things. But at the same time, he was a fairly acute observer. He knew the people he was talking about from earlier days. And I think he didn't know as much about what went on, but he certainly knew what he was talking about. Maybe he was a little bit more critical then, because if you're working with people, you can hardly say what you really think. In fact, in one part, he says something about Jack McEwan, and said, "McEwan has always needed careful handling." So that was clear that when he was there, when they were working together, he would never have said some of the things he said in the letters. Well, he wouldn't have said them publicly anyway. It's only now that I'm doing the dirty on him.
Question here.
To some of this, your father's association with Santa Maria later in his life seems unusual.
He had a lot of unusual friends, but he admired Santa Maria. He thought he had a very good political brain. He thought he understood politics and what was going on. And I think they had a good rapport. He had a good rapport with a lot of people who thought differently from him politically. I mean, look at him in the House of Representatives. He had friends on the other side. And he said in the letters, I was sorry to see my old sparring partner, Pollard, defeated at the election. And he meant it. They didn't agree. But personally, they got on. That, I think, is where it is so different from today. And they were good-tempered, much more good. Well, I suppose not always, but they were. They got on.
You also had a good relationship with Ben Chifley, did you know?
Very good relationship with Ben Chifley and John Curtin. And with Corwell, though he's critical there, but he and Corwell used to sit together at the cricket and football. And obviously didn't talk politics, but they got on very well indeed, which is nice.
So Robin, up the back, yeah.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. If I could just ask about Sir Robert's views about other women, in particular in the political sphere. I suppose Nancy Wake comes to mind at the moment, but did he express a view on Margaret Thatcher becoming leader of the opposition? What do you suppose, putting party politics aside, are his views on having a woman Prime Minister as a president might be?
I won't comment on the present at all. I think he had no dealings with Margaret Thatcher until after he retired, I think, did he? No, couldn't have. But I know he met her and knew her, and I think he admired her too. But I'm sorry, I can't say any more than that. And Nancy Wake, I remember when she stood for Parliament, but I didn't meet her. I don't know what my father thought.
Well, he probably would have liked her because she nearly defeated Bert Everett in 1949.
That's right. Trust you to remember that.
She went very close to defeating Bert Everett in a seat in Sydney.
Yes.
But not quite. But the seat of St George, wasn't it? Down in the... Yeah, there's a question there. Yeah.
I always thought your father was rather Churchillian in some ways. Can you talk about his relationship with Churchill, if he had one?
Relationship between Menzies and Churchill, yeah.
Yes, that takes about half an hour, I think. But there's a book that was brought out by Alan Martin and Patsy Hardy, which was my father's diary that he wrote in 1941 when he went to England. And if you read that, you will see exactly what he thought of Churchill, because he started off being very critical. He said none of these other people will stand up to him at all. And so that, of course, did stand up to him. But I think it was a little bit sticky to begin with. But he got to know the Churchill family. He ended up being a great admirer of Churchill's, and they got on extremely well. And to this day, Mary Churchill is a very good friend of mine. So that has gone on in the family. And as I said before, Lady Churchill asked him to speak at Winston's funeral. So that shows the sort of feeling there was between them. And there's a very nice bit in the book, which I can't remember to quote, but where he talks about going to see Churchill when he was an old man, and what it was like, what he was like. And it is a beautiful pen picture, I suppose, of what Churchill's life was like in his old age.
Stuart.
Did he, 30 following on from that question, that period of time, when he was in the United Australia Party, and in his first prime ministership, 39 to 41, did he ever express to you previously to that what his relationship was like with Joe Lyons and how his fall from power in 1941 affected him?
There's a question about Menzies' relationship with Joseph Lyons, who was the Prime Minister up to 39, and Menzies' fall from office in 1940. 1941 when he was replaced by Arthur Fatt.
Mm.
Just talk into the microphone down that way.
He and Lyons got on very well. He supported Lyons wholeheartedly. I know there are all sorts of stories to the consequence, contrary. But Lyons depended on my father a lot. And Dad supported him until they decided, I hope I get this right, you'll know it better than me, they were going to not have the insurance policy, that's right, national insurance policy. And my father had gone back to his electorate and said, this policy will go through. And he'd explained it very carefully, and he had worked on it, and he was left to draft the legislation for it. They had a meeting in Hobart about it. He and Lyons and some of the other ministers, I'm not sure who was involved. And they came back to Melbourne, where Dad got off to go back to the family, and the others went on to Canberra. And in Canberra, they had a dinner at the lodge, and they decided to scrap the insurance policy. Well, my father had no choice but to resign, because he had gone out and said to people, I guarantee this will go through. He could do nothing else.
In 1941, did he talk to you about how he felt when he lost office in 1941 and what was an internal party, a bit like the Kevin Rudd undoing? Yeah. Did he ever talk about that?
Probably, but I can't remember what he said.
There's not much record that he did speak about it.
No, I don't think he did.
Tom Switzer, and then we go to...
Mr. Henderson, Tom Switzer from the Spectator magazine. Wonderful remarks. And the Spectator will review it, no doubt sympathetically.
I hope.
In 1974, the esteemed journalist David McNichol had an off-the-record discussion with your father. And those remarks were revealed about, I think, a year after he passed away in 1978. And of course, those were revealed, among other things, critical comments that Sir Robin made about his successes in the Liberal Party. You've been quite critical of David McNichol for making those remarks, revealing the comments. Have you changed your opinion of life and just declared?
No. No, and I wouldn't use the word esteemed, not in my view. I think he went to see my father. He rang my father's secretary and said, I'd like to go and see him, talk to him. And Miss Craig said, yes, the boss will see you, but no tape recorder. So that was all right, he agreed, but then he arrived with a tape recorder. And Hazel said, no tape recorder. David said, I'll just take it in, that's all right. He took it in, he turned it on. And I know his son claims that he told my father it was turned on. Well, Dad wouldn't have known if it was on or off. He was busy talking, and he thought he was talking to a friend. And so he talked quite freely about what he thought. David knew it was in private. It was not something to be discussed publicly. And I thought it was most unfair of him to publish that not very long after my father died. And when Dad had been careful in his books, everything else, not to be critical of people. And there he was saying exactly what he thought about everybody, which he would never, never have done publicly. He did not like hurting the families of people like McMahon. And yes, I've done the same thing. But on the other hand, this is many, many years later. And I think now it is, as Doug said, history. And it doesn't matter so much. And it does show what he was like. But I would never have thought of saying any of this in earlier years.
Just to clarify, I wrote to David McNichol Sr. and put in your case about that tape. And also the case of Hazel Craig, who is Mr. Robert Minty's private secretary, who agreed with you. And I wrote to David who was a courteous man, and he didn't reply. And the fact that he didn't reply, I think, meant that he accepted what I put in the letter. Because if he hadn't accepted what I put in the letter, which was essentially your case, I think he would have replied. So that letter's still in the file somewhere. But it was interesting that he didn't want to get into the argument.
Okay, I'll tell you one other thing. I saw David McNichol somewhere at a big party, years and years later. And suddenly we were face to face, and he looked at me and held out his hand and said, "Will you shake hands?" Now that was an admission.
Yeah, what he said was terrific, I must say. The comments were terrific.
Yes, I can't disagree with that.
Oh, they're wonderful comments. Troy Bramson, yeah.
Thanks, Jared. I wanted to ask you about...
Troy, just speak up a bit, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Robert Menzies' thoughts about the Liberal Party, and it's reflected in the letters that he became disillusioned with the party that he helped found in his post-prime ministerial life. I wanted you to comment on the key reasons for that, and do you accept the suggestion that in his later life he actually voted DLP and not for the Liberal Party?
The fact that he voted DLP was nothing whatever to do with the Liberal Party, I'm afraid. It was to do with his electorate. And otherwise, I don't think I've got any comment.
Michael Yabsley. In other words, he didn't like the local candidate, I think.
Heather, thank you for this extraordinary insight into history. The lead up to tonight makes the point that this recognises the lost art of letter writing.
Yes.
Do you have any pearl, any idea about how, in the age of electronic communication, how there might be some revival of the great art of letter writing?
Seems highly unlikely at the moment, doesn't it? But at least these letters remind people that letter writing did exist and how valuable it is, because a little email is not the same at all. So I think, apart from anything else, the letters are valuable for that reason, because they're letters.
Right, there's a question there. Robert, we go David, and over here we've got a big question. Yeah, you have one, so see how we go. Yep.
Mr. Henderson, last time I saw you was on the stage in Melbourne Town Hall. I think it'd be just prior to the 1955 election campaign. And many of us young fellows didn't go to hear your father. We went to see you.
Oh.
And you know, the thought would go through our mind. I could see our passing by. You know. Two questions, quick questions. It's number one, did you like being on the stage? Did you accompany your father on those election campaigns? Did you find it trying or not? And secondly, is there anything in your book about the Petrov Commission, or did your father throw any light on that episode of Australian history that we don't know about?
Well, the first question is about sitting on platforms. It depended who was speaking and how long they were speaking and how boring they were. Dad was always interesting, so that was fine, except on an election tour when I'd heard the same argument so many times I could have made the speech myself. But I don't think it sank into me much. I don't think it ever has quite sunk into me that I was up there on stage. It was just there. I was there with my parents. So now what was the next one?
On the whether he spoke to you much about the Petrov Commission.
Oh, the Petrov. In the letters he mentions a bit about Everton and the Petrov Commission, but there is a little bit in the books, but not a lot.
And he wrote about it in his own book, yeah. Robert.
Mrs. Henderson, what happens next to this wonderful collection of letters? Will the entire collection be available to researchers at some stage?
I think they must be, because... Somebody needs to see the whole thing, and they need to be there on the record. So yes, we will lodge them with the library or something of that sort. A lot of the things we cut out are boring, you know, arrangements and family things, but a lot of it is should be made available, I think, in due course.
But it wasn't all boring, because without giving names away, your husband told me that one of the references taken out was about an act of vulgarity by a prominent liberal and someone else, and the act did seem pretty vulgar and seemed pretty true.
Mm. Yeah, but it is still there, it's just compressed. We've cut out a lot.
There might be a second edition.
Yes. that'll cost more.
That'll cost David, yes.
Thank you, Heather, for a wonderful...
David, just speak up a bit. Yep.
As somebody who's known you and Peter ever since I joined the Department of Foreign Affairs over 50 years ago, having seen you in many places since, there's one thing I'd like to say, and that is that in a litany of correspondence, there are two people involved. Your father, of course, was the Prime Minister. He was known by people throughout the world. But you were the recipient of all these letters. I wonder what your letters to him might have looked like if they still exist. But the reason why I say this is that while you point out his sense of humour, while you point out the importance of family to him, what you didn't really mention, and which I haven't seen in any of the reviews yet, is the extent to which your father regarded you as a political confidant of no small measure. You, in your own right, I think, deserve rather more of the discussion we're having this evening than it has so far occurred.
Oh, look, keep going. Well, yes, actually, we had an editor to do all sorts of bits with the books, the book and the letters. And he wanted me to fill in some of the bits where my father had commented on things. And so my mother did keep all my letters. So they exist. And I got out the ones, merely the ones that were appropriate to the bit in the book that he mentions. And I have not yet read my letters. As Jack Waterford, actually, in the Canberra Times, he said he is looking forward to reading Heather's letters. Well, I can assure you, I'm sure they're very ordinary and nothing, but Dad's very flattering, that's all. But they do exist, yes.
We always knew as youngsters, if we were meant to be the neighbours of the Menzies House Road, that Dame Patty was the one that had a fixed electricity bulb.
The suggestion is that Dame Patty was the one who fixed the electricity bulbs.
No argument there, whatever. Dad was absolutely hopeless at anything practical like that. My mother did everything. She was a great one, sort of like Heath Robinson. She has little things all over the house that worked because she fiddled with them. She certainly changed the light globes, yes.
Okay, so we're really getting very good. We'll take a final question up the back because we're getting right to the end. Yep.
You mentioned that your uncle sang. I've always thought that Sir Robert, his oratory had a cadence to it. Did he sing?
Did Robert Menzies sing? Your uncle sang.
No, yes, Uncle Frank sang. No, Dad, he sang in tune. Yes, he had a quite good voice, but he didn't ever sing the way Frank did, because Frank actually sang songs. Dad would sing along with whatever it was, but no, he had a good sense of tune and all that sort of thing, but otherwise, no.
So, are you likely to do any more of this, or is this...
You've got to be joking, mate.
If when you were last at the Sydney Institute in 1994, I'd suggest that to you that you'd put out a book of your father's letters, you would have said to me, you've got to be kidding me.
Yes, I would have. Yeah. Yes. Well, wait another 16 years.
Okay. Heather Henderson, many thanks. Take a seat over there. Well, it's great to have Heather Henderson back at the Sydney Institute. It's been a wonderful night tonight. It's important personal recollections about one of the most important Australians, Sir Robert Menzies, but also great insights into Heather Henderson and the Menzies family. So it's been a wonderful occasion, and it's great that it's been recorded tonight, and in time Anne Henderson will publish the paper in the Sydney papers online. There are copies of Letters to My Daughter here. I'm sure some people have bought copies already. I'm sure Heather Henderson will be happy to sign them. And all I'll say at the moment is thanks for tonight, a terrific night, wonderful night, and we'll have you back in the future, so thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.